Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about physical therapy on the program today, and we're going to start by taking a look at lower back pain and how to stick with your therapist's exercise plans. Our two regular physical therapists are back for all your questions. Could be about lower back, could be something else as well. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, professor and the doctor of physical therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, welcome back.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to see you.
Awesome to be here. It's a beautiful September day.
It is indeed. And as we talk with our experts, I hope you'll join in. Let us know what's making your lower back hurt. What movements are harder to do, maybe? We'll take your general physical therapy questions, of course, as well. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Lori, let's start with you. You brought a study today that looks at the relationship between lower back pain and the completion of at-home exercises assigned by a physical therapist.
Yes. This was a secondary analysis of a primary study that was looking at the use of a smartphone app to increase adherence. So I've been a physical therapist for a long time. Oh, you're laughing. Yeah, very nice. And so, you know, when I was a new therapist, we would see our patients three times a week. They'd come in for an hour, and we would see them for months three times a week. So we were pretty clear on their adherence to their program. But with changes in the healthcare system and so on, patients are seen and they are often given homework. And it is September. It is the month of homework. So our patients get homework and they need to do this at home. So this study looked at how well people adhered to their home exercise program. And they found there were three different trajectories. The first was a declining adherence, and that was about 12% of people. Stable adherence, where they kind of stayed the same, that was 45%, and increasing adherence, which was about 43%. So 80 some percent either maintained the adherence that the therapist recommended, like this number of exercises, this number of times per day, and so on. And then there was another group, 40 some percent, who actually increased. Now, one of the questions is, how do you measure adherence? And often these are self-report. So people often, Larry's already laughing.
Round up. Everyone rounds up.
Everybody rounds up. So, and there was an interesting study a few years ago where they looked at, for lack of a better phrase, how honest people were about their adherence to their home program. So they asked people to keep a log of how often they did their exercises and how many repetitions. And unbeknownst to the subjects, there was an accelerometer placed in the ankle weight. And they found, not surprisingly, that there was a pretty big mismatch between what the patients reported they were doing and what they were actually doing. So sort of the take-home message is you really need to be honest with your provider about what you're doing, because if you're not getting better and we assume you're doing what we told you to do or suggested that you do, then there's something wrong with our home exercise prescription. So, you know, being honest, and I had someone come in the other day and say, yeah, I was given some exercises, I'm not doing them. So that gives me a lot of information about, I understand why you're not better, and I have to do a better job giving you things to do at home that you will actually be able to do.
How do you figure that out in the first place? I mean, how does a physical therapist decide on what to do, Jill?
Right. That is very challenging clinical decision making. And as you have more experience, like Lori and myself, you get better at hitting the bullseye. But as a newer clinician, I tell the students, just try and hit the wall that the target is on. It's very challenging. we have a tendency to overdose patients. And then you wonder, Lori, about this 12%, even though these individuals were all seen by the same therapist, I believe, did these people discontinue because their exercises were too hard? Or did they discontinue because the intent of the exercise wasn't explained to them? Or maybe it wasn't explained to them that they'd be sore for a couple of hours and then their pain should subside. So all of those things are factors when you're designing an exercise program for people. And one of the things, it's interesting that Lori alluded to, when she first started practicing, you could see patients frequently. So if you overdosed them or underdosed them, you could make those changes right away in the next couple of visits. Now you can't because you don't get to see your patients that often. So now you spend some of your time trusting that your patient can up their exercise program safely and effectively, or down-regulate them safely and effectively as well. And a lot of that onus now falls on the patient, which traditionally fell on the healthcare provider. That's a big change we've seen with healthcare.
Right. And a lot of our time now is spent educating the patient. So the general rule of thumb is probably no more than 7 exercises ever at once to give these people at once. And then tremendous amount of education of this is what you should feel. So one of my big pet peeves is as I'll be doing an exercise with someone and I'll say, what are you feeling? And instead of telling me what they're feeling, they'll tell me how they're feeling. Oh, it's fine. I'm like, no, because their judgment of what's fine may not be what I think is fine. As in, they may be feeling it in the wrong place, and it's not achieving the goal that I'm looking for. They may be feeling it in their back instead of their hip, or they may be feeling pain rather than stretching. So it's not, you know, is what you're feeling okay, but tell me specifically what you're feeling. And a lot of that comes with experience, with, you know, having had things go the wrong direction.
So you have to communicate that.
Lots of communication.
And as you can imagine, it can be overwhelming for a patient when you are literally just trying to give them all this information. You're trying to educate them about their diagnosis, trying to educate them about their prognosis. And as Lori talked about, you need to educate them about their exercises and what they should feel and what they should experience. And all of this becomes so challenging, especially if you can't see your patient back for 2 weeks. Now you're kind of throwing caution into the wind and hoping that they heard the right things and are doing the right activities. And so that second visit for me becomes very crucial of, I sent you with some homework, as Lori alluded to, how did you do it? How are you feeling with this one, that one, et cetera? And so those follow-up visits actually become a lot of conversations about what you're doing at home.
I'm just wondering how you communicate. Let's say I'm the patient and these aren't working for me. I can't complete them or whatever. Mm-hmm. How then can I email you or how does that work?
Yes.
I mean, what should people do if it's not working?
So in the UW system, we have the MyChart option. Mm. So patients should opt in for MyChart, and you don't have to be terribly computer savvy to manage MyChart. And you can go in and you can send your provider a message and just say, hey, when I do this exercise, I'm feeling this. Or, you know, I had someone come in this morning before I came to the studio who said, when I do my exercises, I'm feeling it in a different place than was anticipated, and now I have pain there. So there may be something wrong with that exercise. So my first step is always to see if I can modify that exercise. So I don't think of exercise as a yes-no in most cases, although some, but more, well, let's see how you're doing it. Can we change how you're doing that exercise so it doesn't hurt or doesn't create these symptoms? What are we learning from your response to that exercise that I need to know to help you to get better?
And the tricky thing with that is if you're limited in time by your visit, let's say you're only limited to a 30-minute visit, you can't see your patient do the full repetitions or dose that you're going to send them home with. So you basically do a snapshot and you're hypothesizing, well, they did 8 here successfully. I think they could do a 2x8 or a 3x8 at home. So again, that comes with physical therapy practice as well. And so sometimes you have to teach your patient to titrate up. So I want you to do half of this rehab program for 2 days, then go on and do 75% of it, then ramp up to 100%. So as Lori alluded to, there's a ton of education that goes into this.
I want to turn to the lower back for a minute before we go to Vicki from Mequon and other callers potentially here. It seems like everybody has lower back pain at some point in their life.
That is true.
So what's the total area for the lower back?
Well, it typically, we know what people think of as the area of their low back, but it can move up to their mid back. Hmm. And what we see more often is that it goes down into their hips and sometimes down into their legs. So, you know, low back pain that stays in your low back is much more easily treated than low back pain that radiates or extends beyond the specific body area of your low back.
And why the heck are we so susceptible to
a poor design? No offense, right. No offense to the big guy, but L4, L5, and the curvature in the lumbar spine, particularly for people who do not have good abdominal control, increases that curvature in your low back, and it's a tremendous strain on those segments.
So yeah, approximately 80% of people will have at least one episode of low back pain in their lifetime, and Larry just recently joined that club, unfortunately, but he's done very, very well because he is healthy, fit, exercises, knows what to do, has good aerobic endurance and all of those things going for him. But a lot of people refer to the low back pain as the common cold of the musculoskeletal system. Eventually, everybody gets one.
So when should you see a medical professional for lower back pain?
Well, typically, if your pain has lasted more than 3 or 4 weeks, most people will recover in 6 weeks, particularly if there was an inciting event that did something. And certainly if you have symptoms that radiate down your legs and then the red flags. Jill, you want to go through the red flags?
Sure. Red flags would be changes in bowel or bladder, progressive neurological weakness, such as, gosh, I had some numbness and tingling in my foot, and now I can't lift my foot up. Those would definitely be things that would warrant medical attention. The other thing I would say is if you have an increase in frequency of episodes of low back pain, so yeah, I get over them, but gosh, they're happening a lot more often, that would be a good time to see a physical therapist.
We have, let's go to Vicki and Mequon next. Hi, Vicki. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had an injury back in December. I'm 66. I was walking my dog, and she pulled me down, and I tore my rotator cuff, actually on both shoulders. But I had been doing physical therapy for about 4 months. I'm a very compliant and motivated patient, but I wasn't progressing to completely back to normal, so I opted for surgery. And he did do some debridement and put an anchor in my supraspinatus, I guess it was. And so that was in May. And I've been in physical therapist. I have a great therapist, but I'm struggling with stiffness. I did have one of those chairs, you know, that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
CPM chair.
You know, CPM chair,
you.
Yeah.
And I used that for over a month, but wasn't progressing. So I'm just super frustrated. I had no idea that it was going to take this long to recover and the pain. So I'm just curious if you have experience with that stiffness. My doctor said like 20% of patients have stiffness. And I'm just wondering, is it tincture of time that I'm dealing with? And just, you know, keep on being the good soldier or...
Sure.
Yeah. Those are great questions, Vicki. And it sounds like you had a debridement with a rotator cuff repair, and you you are at risk for stiffness because you are a female in the age category that's at risk of a frozen shoulder. So giving you that CPM chair to increase your motion is a really good way to stave off the risk of having a frozen shoulder. But a lot of people battle stiffness post-surgery. So can you raise your arm overhead? Where is your motion at this point? Because you're about 4 or 5
yeah,
minutes out.
I'm really been working. I'm making like baby steps. I'm about at 150 to 156 flexions.
Okay.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm getting up there, but it's just like 1 degree a week is basically.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's
pretty good.
That's okay. We'll take it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing you have to remember, Vicki, is you might have 180 degrees of flexion and abduction on your uninvolved side. But honestly, between, 165 and 170, unless you do a lot of overhead activity, can be considered fairly functional. So you're getting into the range of what we consider, hey, you're doing okay.
Right. Did your stiffness come on after the surgery? Did you not have that prior to surgery?
Right. I did not have it prior to surgery.
Okay. Yeah. So then, the good news is you're only 4 months out.
Right.
So you have, 150, 160 degrees at 4 months. It should continue to improve literally over the next 12 months. And I know it feels like a slow boat, but in this age group, connective tissue stiffness, connective tissue changes happen very slowly. And it's the people who stick with it, even though you're only getting a degree a month or so, you're going to get there eventually. When this gets to that, what we call the thawing stage, you will increase your range of motion. You just have to stick with it.
Good luck, Vicki. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Lori Tyne-Brody, our guest today from the UW. It's always great to have them with us. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody, UW physical therapist at UW-Madison. Jill's in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW. Lori, a therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Let's take another call. Connie in Portage will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. I have an unusual problem. I have an infection in my body that won't go away, and they sent me to infectious disease. They can't cure it either. But what I have is from the MRI, I have a really bad back, and I have one knee bone on bone, and the other one is going, and I can't take pain pills. Now, what can I do for exercise? Everybody says exercise, but I can't walk. They won't do my knees because he says it takes, you have to be able to stand to rehab, and my back is too bad. So what? I don't know what to do for exercise.
So what are the restrictions due to your infection?
Well, it's a bladder. I had bladder cancer, and that has been 6 years ago, and it went away, and I had...
We lost Connie.
Well, I guess my first question is whether or not she can get in a pool.
Right, that's my first thought,
mm-hmm.
too.
Whether or not she's able to do that, because that would be the place for her. If there's no contraindication relative to her infection, we don't let people with open wounds get into the pool due to a risk of infection, but I'm not clear about the specifics of her infection, whether or not that would be contraindicated. That would be a question for the infectious disease people. I believe I have seen people in the pool in the past who have had infections. So that would be one option. Jill, you're raising your hand.
Well, I'm wondering if something like a new step or mm-hmm. a recumbent bike where she's non-weight bearing, but her back is supported on both of those, depending on what her bad back is, if mm-hmm. that would be a way to increase cardiovascular activity, get some motion through her lower extremities, and if that might be another way to go as well. I'm not sure if she's seen a physical therapist or not, but based on this information within these constraints, I think a physical therapist could find some strategies for Connie so she could exercise.
Yeah, I like the recumbent bike and the new step. Those are both great suggestions for land-based activities.
And, of course, the pool.
And, of course, the pool.
All
Who
right.
doesn't love a pool?
Glenn in Waupaca will give you a chance. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. I've got both knees replaced, both hips replaced, and a bad SI joint. And so I did a lot of therapy, but I had a sciatic nerve problem that wouldn't go away. And my friend suggested that I go to a lady who does acupuncture. And we did a couple of sessions with that, and it went away. And when I have other things, she takes care of it. And about a month ago, I says, well, I've had floaters for the last year and so bad. And she says, well, I can take care of that. And we did two sessions with floaters and are basically gone. So I'm really, really enthused about going to acupuncture.
Well, Glenn, thanks a lot for calling. Jill, a comment?
Sure, absolutely. We fully support our allied health professional colleagues, acupuncturists, reflexologists, things like that. Lori and I are both clients of an acupuncturist at one point in our lives. And so we wholeheartedly embrace those ideas and concepts. And Glenn, I really thank you for sharing this information with us. It's you know, the most important thing is that we find a path for you to get better. And whoever that best professional is for you, that's fantastic.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of people in our facility, in addition to coming to physical therapy, they also utilize massage therapy, as well as our acupuncturists, as well as chiropractors.
Glenn, thank you again. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way. Open lines get you on fairly quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Ron in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I was a letter carrier for 35 years, and I've made probably 10,000 motions of extending my arm to case mail or put it in a mailbox. And I think the front of my collarbone right below my throat is protruding. But now I've noticed that when, like, I swim, it starts to hurt, or when I lift things. Anything I can do about that?
So are you talking about, were you a driver and just always had to put your arm out of the little mail carrier car and then come back in, Ron?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Yep, sure. And so you think about that. That's a really long lever, and he could be putting a lot of heavy mail in and out of the mailbox. And so that's a lot of load on your AC joint and your SC joint.
Yep.
Yeah, and so it's interesting. Your SC joint, Ron, is that sternoclavicular joint right where your clavicle comes into kind of your sternum or your breastbone. And typically, we don't see a lot of people with pathology there. But honestly, 35 years of doing that seems like the perfect mechanism of injury to have either some arthritic changes there, some degenerative changes at his SC joint, which isn't very common. Right, Lori? Would you agree?
Right. I agree. I did see somebody this summer with SC joint instability, anterior instability. Mm-hmm. So the important thing to know is if you have posterior instability, that could be life-threatening because of the vasculature relative to your heart. But I would go see a physical therapist and get examined and see if they can give you any activities to help stabilize that joint, or perhaps it needs to be mobilized one direction, or modifying your swim stroke so that you are not aggravating that joint. So there are various techniques you could use in terms of your swimming to modify that and minimize the load on that SC joint. So I'd make an appointment with a physical therapist, particularly if you can find one who specializes in upper extremity.
Yes.
There you go, Ron. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Pat in Superior emailed us. They're having problems with the SI joint. They've exhausted their PT help and have started getting limited relief from injections. Any thoughts about the implants they use? They need less pain.
So I'm not familiar with implants being used in the SI joint right now. So if it's SI joint instability, the injections they use our sclerosing injections to provide stability. Sometimes if it's an arthritic issue, they will do cortisone injections. So it's hard to know what kind of physical therapy they have exhausted. If they've been with one physical therapist, they may want to go to see somebody who specializes in spine or even pelvic floor, because that can come into play with SI joint as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think when they're talking about implants, they're talking about those interspinal
cages?
No. Those little pain monitor thingy bobbies where you.
Oh.
I wonder if that's what they're talking about as an overall implant, not anything specific for their SI joint. If they're thinking chronic pain.
Yeah. An implanted pain pump.
Thank you.
That's what I pain pump. Those
intrathecal pain pump. That's what I was saying.
Yeah. I have patients who use those and find them to be tremendously helpful. So they are a pump that's implanted. So rather than taking an oral pain medication, they are implanted directly in the area of the spinal cord, and they can, and it's designed to provide a bolus of pain relieving medication.
I don't know, Lori, have you ever seen one for people with SI pathology? I feel like most of the people I see it for or I've heard of is more lumbar spine. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much research or evidence there is on using that for an SI problem.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't know that either.
Let's go to John in River Falls next. John, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've got an issue with riding either in a car or a truck. It starts in my hips. Or actually my gluteus maximus, and then it goes down into my legs. I can ride for an hour, and then after that, then I start getting pain in both legs, and I'm using a donut. I'm exercising. Play pickleball about 4 or 5 times a week. I wear a back brace, knee braces, installed tile for 40 years. So some of this stuff is kind of wore out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is it just when you're riding or when you're driving, or it doesn't matter?
Nope, it doesn't matter whether I'm driving or I'm riding.
Okay. So, you know, the donut is going to relieve tension on your tailbone, but it's still going to put pressure on your piriformis and your sciatic nerve. So how is the donut compared to no donut?
It's much better.
Okay. All right.
Near as off or as soon. It's later, but
okay. And then when
I do the hip exercises, the hip raises. Mm-hmm. I had some knee problems, so then I do the side leg raises, and I still have the rubber bands, and I use the walking. So I'm trying to build up the muscles around it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you could also try, instead of the donut, you could try the towel roll underneath each thigh. So you don't have pressure right on your tush. So it may be that the pressure of the donut is also causing some sciatic symptoms. So if you take a couple towel rolls and put them underneath your thigh so that your tush is completely off, completely non-weight bearing, that may help.
Yeah.
Right. I think even alternating between those things might be a good idea for John. It's just that weight or load distribution needs to be shifted around periodically. We can't just keep loading one part of his gluteus maximus, because it sounds like he's very active and does a lot to take care of himself. So we certainly want to keep him on that pickleball court.
Yeah. So the question is if it's the coming directly from his glutes or if it's the weight bearing on his spine. So you still don't know. So changing positions frequently for anybody, joints are designed to move. So if you stay in one position for an hour, even people with healthy joints are going to hurt.
Even people on the air sometimes when they have 90-minute
radio show.
But if John doesn't turn the corner, he should see a physical therapist, because this would be somebody I'd like to see in person. As Lori alluded to, we're not 100% sure where the source of symptoms are with John. And I'd like to kind of see his seated position in the car, things like that. I always think about the vibration being a factor in a car.
Right.
So there's other variables besides just maybe the sitting. So,
Yeah.
John, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Nick in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question. It might be psychological or it might be physical. I got my brain injury in June 9th, 21, and now I've got a new symptom. Like, I was at school today, which I'm going to school to try and better myself, and walking out the door, it felt like the left foot, like I was stomping it every time I stepped. And I notice I drag it too once in a while. I was wondering what your suggestions are on that.
Do you have pain with it? Do you have back pain? Anything like that, Nick?
No, I've noticed I drag my foot, and today it's just extremely where I'm dragging my foot, like I'm stomping on it every time I step. It's really bizarre.
So has this been a consistent pattern since your brain injury? Yeah. Or is this new?
No, it's been consistent. I can trip over anything with the left foot.
So I'm sorry. Did it start after your brain injury, or did it only start recently?
Oh no, it happened right after my brain injury.
Okay,
and it's just progressively getting worse.
All right, so yeah, now it's time to go back and see probably your neurologic physical therapist who has been working with you since your brain injury. Because the question is, well, is it a mechanical problem? Did something happen in your back? And it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like it's more likely to be central. Maybe it's because you're fatigued,
right.
And so you have less dynamic control.
Yeah.
Right, and it may be that you need an AFO or a spring-loaded AFO or some sort of little mechanical assistive device on that side, because the last thing we want you to do is fall.
Yeah.
So we
right.
want to make sure you're tripping over things, and we want to make sure that you stay upright and fall. You're going to school, and we want to keep that brain working, Nick. So,
exactly.
I would definitely see your physical therapist report, you know, your symptoms are getting worse, more frequency, and have them evaluate you.
Right. That's something that you alluded to at the beginning of the show, Jill, when Larry asked why you would see your physical therapist, and one of those is increasing frequency of your symptoms, shorter time frame between symptoms. So this is another case where that applies.
Nick, good luck. Yeah,
thanks,
thank
Nick.
You. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Luann in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Luann.
Hi. I had a hip replacement about 6 years ago and have been using a cane ever since. I had a posterior replacement, and it just didn't seem to work very well. And I finally got an opinion from another orthopedic surgeon, whom I now trust a whole lot more. And he said that the muscles just didn't grow back together. And he said that that happens in a certain percentage of time. I do have, after I got over a great deal of depression, I have some exercises to do. Is there any chance that I'll be able to walk without this cane?
So first of all, just to kind of explain, these are great questions, Luann, and you're a great historian. So a posterolateral approach for a total hip replacement does require the surgeon to either take down or go through the gluteus medius, which is, I'm guessing, the muscle that your second opinion physician thought may not have healed appropriately, which can cause a limp or weakness on the lateral side of your hip. So I'm guessing that's why you're still using the cane. So far, so good, Luann?
Yep, and to my undying grumpiness, I didn't listen to a friend who said, if you're going to get your hip replaced, get an anterior. And so...
There's pros and cons to each, so let the buyer beware. I think, the first thing I think about, Lori, is possibly putting her in the pool, mm-hmm. and making sure that these exercises are targeting what they should be targeting.
Yeah. Yeah. We see a lot of that. I see it often, and that it's hard for people to know which muscles they're activating when they do an exercise,
yes.
which is where the education comes in, because often people have been substituting for so many months of their life that they no longer remember how to fire the muscles we want them to fire. So I have seen people who have not had a return of their gluteal muscle strength following a hip replacement, and it takes a long time to train them to get it back. So a really good targeted rehabilitation program works, sometimes some electrical muscle stim to help you identify the muscle that we're trying to target. That can help. So I would say, you know, see a good physical therapist who has the time and willingness to really work with you. Sometimes if you have pain, some dry needling can help some of the other muscles that are being overworked. And sometimes that causes some of the pain, so can help minimize some of that pain and get the right muscles working.
And in the pool, or
in the pool, not electrical stim in the pool, but
But in the pool would be great. But the other thing I was thinking about is if Luann's exercises, as you alluded to, Lori, and this goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show, if they're too hard, she's going to substitute and use the wrong muscles. So when you said you find a really good PT who's going to start her at the level that that muscle needs, which may be relatively low compared to her other muscles.
Exactly.
Luann, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Kay in Sauk Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Kay.
Yeah, I think a couple of months ago when the PTs were on, they said a person was using their hamstrings to support their back when they were in an upright position. And I wondered if you could explain how that happens, that you revert to using that instead of the normal muscles to have yourself upright. And how do you get those muscles to phase back in so you don't use the hamstrings?
When people have pain, they tend to minimize use of the muscles that are the primary movers. And when you're talking about the low back, hip, thigh, there's a lot of muscles that can do various different activities. And so if you are not, for example, if you are bending forward and you're using your hamstrings instead of your glutes to control your forward motion, if you are stepping up the stairs and using the hamstrings instead of the glutes, the hamstrings work as a support muscle group. You know, they're what we would call a secondary mover for some of these activities. And so sometimes what happens is you promote them to a primary mover, and they're not supposed to be doing that. So what we really want in general is the right muscle engaging at the right time to do the right job. So so that's generally what we mean. And oftentimes we see that around the hip and the low back when we have that kind of an issue. And how do you get them to not do it? That's where the training with a physical therapist comes in. I can look at somebody even in the pool and watch how they're moving when they're walking sideways, when they're doing leg lifts. And I can see whether or not they're substituting with a different muscle group. In some cases, not all cases, when it gets down to really fine stuff. But a lot of times I can see when people are using their back muscles instead of their hip muscles. So you really need to work with a physical therapist who can train you to use the right muscles.
And this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier. When you give somebody an exercise and they say, "Oh, I feel it," the follow-up is where? Because we may be giving you a muscle that's supposed to activate your gluteal muscles, and in reality, you're only feeling it in your hamstring. And so it gets back to finding a good physical therapist who will ask you those questions so the intent of the exercise is doing what it is supposed to do. Glutes is a challenging one, in particular for women. Women have a very difficult time firing their gluteal muscles. So,
Kay, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Lori Tyne-Brody, our physical therapist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Mm-hmm. taking a look at physical therapy issues on the show today with our guest, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Brad emailed us. He's dealing with Morton's neuroma, wondering if there are any at-home techniques to alleviate or tame pain, or good online resources to dig into.
So a Morton's neuroma is a kind of wad of neurologic tissue in between typically your third and fourth or your second and third toes. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a Morton's neuroma. A lot of people have pain when they go up on their toes. For example, they feel that. The classic thing was when Stairmasters first came out and people were on Stairmasters on their toes. A lot of people either developed or created pain in their Morton's neuroma. One of the first things I would do for Brad is it'd be helpful to know what he does for a living or his lifestyle, but is make sure that the toe box of his shoe is wide enough, because if the toe box is too narrow, it's going to cause compression and irritation of that Morton's neuroma. Is that what you're thinking, Lori?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then sometimes an arch support with a metatarsal pad. So it will sort of splay, for lack of a better term, increase the space between the toes. And then just some general mobilization of the foot. So if he hasn't seen a physical therapist who can examine his foot and come up with some strategies to see if there are other issues in his foot that predisposed him to this. And another thing in terms of the shoes, you know, you mentioned the toe box, which is important, but if you're going to use an orthotic, and this is true for any orthotics, not just those with the metatarsal pad that you might use for a Morton's neuroma, is to make sure that the counter of your shoe is solid and stable. So this is for all those parents whose kids kick their shoes on and off without untying them. Untie your shoes, because as you put your foot in and out of your shoe without untying it, you break down the back, the heel part. We call it the counter of the shoe. And it's the control of the heel that controls the mechanics of your foot farther forward. So if the back of your heel or the back of your shoe is really sloppy, your orthotic is not going to do you any good. So it's really important to have a really stable shoe.
Michael in Mequon has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. About 11 years ago, I had my left hip replaced, one of the best things I ever did. However, every once in a while, I get a very sharp pain in the lower third of that femur and unable to walk without a pronounced limp. Is it likely that might be like a T-band kind of a thing that might be helped with physical therapy? Or is that just what happens with some people who get a hip replacement from the rod going down the femur?
Jill?
So as you said, it was 6 years ago, Michael, that you had your...
11.
Oh, 11 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about loosening, Lori?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, how often does this happen, Michael?
It's periodic.
What's periodic in your world?
It might be a couple times a month. It might be it's usually for a couple days in a row, but it's not a constant thing.
Okay. So if it is.
And it started, mm-hmm. started more recently, it started in the last couple of years.
All right. So does it feel like it's really deep, or is it something you feel like you can put your finger on and that's where it hurts?
No, it's more of a non-specific ache in that lower third, about a third of the way up from the knee.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds more like a little bit of micro motion at the distal end of the implant, because there's not much else that happens right there. So typically the deeper the source of the symptoms, the more vague they feel. You can't put your finger on it. It feels more like a deepish ache, a toothache kinds of thing, rather than a sharp and stabbing kind of pain that you might get with the iliotibial band. So go ahead, Jill.
Well, I was saying, If it's been 11 years since his total hip, it's probably worth a brush up on exercises and activities anyway. I would see a physical therapist. And if there are some contributing factors from an IPT band or something like that, you can get those cleared up. And then if you're still having that deep residual pain, I would be thinking much more loosening, pistoning. And then I'd probably go back and see my surgeon.
See the surgeon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do those wear out?
Yeah.
They can. The life expectancy of total joints has increased dramatically with the evolution of joints, but yes, they can absolutely wear out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why you want to delay them as long as possible. But, you know, in contrast to Luann, who had her hip replacement 6 years ago and is still experiencing pain and weakness, you know, more often we see people like Michael who have their hip replacement and they're so happy when they walk out. So the majority of people do really well after a hip replacement. And I've seen patients like Luann where something goes awry. But for the most part, people are pretty darn happy after their hip replacement.
Michael, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. A listener emailed, they're wheelchair bound from an SCI.
Spinal cord injury.
Oh, spinal cord injury. Okay, L1.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend for several chair exercises to increase strengthening?
This would be I would encourage this individual to see a neurologic physical therapist. So this individual is wheelchair bound because they had a spinal cord injury to their L1 nerve root, which is lower extremity. They're interested in some upper body strengthening, but there are very specific things that a physical therapist would recommend that would assist with transfer. So a PT would definitely work on triceps, to make sure that they're able to transfer in and out of their chair independently. But there might be other things that fall within the purview of a neurologic physical therapist who works with individuals who use a wheelchair as their primary mobility that they may know of that are beyond my purview.
Right. And the other thing is you want to make sure to keep the key muscles strong, the ones that they need for transportation. So for pushing their wheelchair, for stabilizing during transfer, the last thing you want to do is overload something and damage the muscles that are so critical for that patient's independence. So I've seen people who have, you know, gone gung-ho on a strengthening program and have actually damaged their rotator cuff or the long head of their biceps or things, you know, muscles that are really critical for independence in their home. So that's why we would suggest seeing somebody who's a neurologic specialist who has more expertise in that area and really get some good guidance on that.
A listener emailed and wants you to, this goes back to an earlier question and comment, please expand on the pros and cons of posterior and anterior hip replacement surgeries. Jill, do you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I'll start with that. So the posterior lateral approach has kind of always been the gold standard. It's what we've seen for years and years and years. And with the posterior lateral approach, the surgeon makes the incision on kind of the back lateral side of your hip, and then they dislocate your hip posteriorly and do the replacement. And to do that, they have to go through the gluteus medius, which is a very important hip stabilizing muscle that we need. If somebody has a posterior lateral approach, their hip precautions are the no flexion, no hip flexion past 90, no taking your leg past midline or crossing your leg past midline, and no internal rotation, particularly those three motions combined. But that's kind of been the gold standard surgery. So some of the challenges with that are the fact that you have to go through the gluteus medius, which is a huge hip stabilizing muscle, and that needs some strengthening and attention afterwards, which can take some time. Lori, do you want to talk about the anterolateral approach?
So the anterolateral approach, as expected, comes on the front side of the hip. And the reason for doing that is so that they don't have to go through the gluteus medius and they don't have those same hip precautions that Jill just suggested. They have different hip precautions, but they're ones that Typically, we don't do quite as often as the other ones. So, for example, the hip flexion past 90, it's hard for people to get their shoes and socks on and things like that. And they tend to move along in their rehab a little faster because of that. The downside is that there are some major vessels in the front of the hip, and you can end up with some damage to those vessels, and you can end up with some scarring in the front of your hip, which limits your hip motion.
Right. Some of the problems that you see with an anterolateral approach is people end up with a hip flexion contracture, mm-hmm. where they can't fully straighten or extend their hip. And if you can't get good hip extension with ambulation, you start using your back, mm-hmm. and then sometimes you can end up with low back pain.
Right.
So there's no perfect surgical approach. Everything has its pros and cons. I think as a patient, the best thing to do is discuss these approaches with your surgeon, what their preference is and what their outcomes are for each one.
Mm-hmm. And I'd ask him or her how many they've done.
How many exactly. they've done, exactly.
That's exactly right.
Because they're all, these surgeons are trained. You're either trained for the posterior or you're trained for the anterior. So whichever one you're best at.
Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, Lori Tine-Brody, our guest today. And they'll be with us right up till 12:30. We're talking all things physical therapy on the show with them today. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with Lori and Jill. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at physical therapy on the show today with our two guests, Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tine-Brody, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lots of callers online. You can join in. I think there's one open line at 800-642-1234, or if you'd like, email us to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go straight to Kate in Duluth, Minnesota. Kate, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for this topic. I have neuropathy. I've had it for a few years. Both upper extremity and lower. And what I've noticed in recent years, there are so many products out there, some having to do with heat, some and cold, some having to do with massage, some having to do with like electrical stimulation. And I'm wondering, is there a certain protocol recommended in physical therapy for neuropathy?
Well, I think, you know, based upon what you said, that sort of gives you your answer in that there is no good protocol. We have no good answers for the treatment of idiopathic neuropathy, and that is neuropathy where we don't know the cause of it, or even diabetic neuropathy, although we know if your diabetes is well controlled, your neuropathy isn't as bad. But the fact that people are putting out creams and stim and massage and this pill and that pill tells you that we don't have any good answers for that. So what we do know is that maintaining an active lifestyle, exercise, eating well, maintaining your body weight. If you're not diabetic, avoiding getting diabetes by taking good care of yourself. Those are the things that we know that will help, not necessarily, you know, prevent your neuropathy from getting worse or whatever, but it helps to control your symptoms and helps you maintain activity and overall health. So you don't develop secondary health events, whether it's, you know, cardiovascular disease, et cetera, from an inactive lifestyle.
Lori, I'm going to ask you this, just your opinion on this. Do you have concerns about somebody with a peripheral neuropathy using heat or ice if they have decreased sensation? And concerned about some negative sequelae that can happen with that. So if you are recommending heat or ice, it's not, you know, it's for a very short amount of time, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. Thank you for pointing that out. So for people who have decreased sensation, staying away from heating pads or ice packs or whatever, because you can injure yourself pretty easily if you don't have good sensation. So you'd have to be very careful. You'd have to check frequently, keep it for short periods of time.
Thank you very much for calling, Kate. Appreciate your call. Janet in Boston, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me. My question is, I do a lot of painting, sitting down, painting pictures and things. And when I sit for quite a long time, and I go to get up, and I can't hardly step. I mean, like where my leg joins on to my body, there's such pain down in that area. And I'm just wondering, I know I have to do stretches and things, and I do, but just wondering what causes that.
Is it groin? Is it in your groin? Is it in your buttock? Where is the pain?
It's more in the groin area, I guess you would say. And I have lower back problems also. Mm-hmm. And that IT band is very sore to touch. So
okay.
I was just wondering if that's a hip flexor thing or what that is that's going on.
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, this is somebody who we think about should probably have a really good ergonomic evaluation. So just similar to an office worker, Janet, where you are seated for a prolonged period of time, we would want to make sure that everything within your position is optimal for you. So do you have a nice chair you sit in? Do you have an ergonomic chair? Anything like that?
Like horseshoe shaped pads that I sit on.
Okay. So that kind of gets back to what Lori was talking about earlier.
Yeah. So the pain where you're experiencing the pain is a primary hip problem. So things that come directly from hip, for example, osteoarthritis, tend to manifest in the groin, and they tend to bother you the most when you get up from having been immobile, especially sitting. The fact that you have some low back issues suggests that those two are probably related. So A, you need to get up more frequently. You just do. So you can set your watch or a timer or something for every 15 minutes and get up and walk. Even when you're sitting, try to change the position of your hip frequently. And I would see a physical therapist for one or two visits to see, to take a look at your back, take a look at your hip, and give you additional suggestions of things that you should do. But in general, for people with your kinds of symptoms, that's where I would start. Jill's raising her hand.
No, okay.
I'm raising my hand. So the other thing to consider, Janet, and I don't know if this would work with you being an artist, but you know, I have a standing desk and you can raise it to multiple different heights. They're not very expensive. And then I can sit on a stool where my hips are in less flexion. I'm still seated, but my hips are in less flexion. So if that's something that you could consider as well, that might just change what Lori alluded to, exactly how you're loading your hips.
That was exactly what I was going to ask about.
Excellent.
Oh, great, Larry.
That's perfect.
I learned that in another show.
Yeah. You don't want to be in the same position for long periods of time because you're loading that spot on your hip joint continuously. So just changing position again, it comes down to that. Lots of movement. That's why they make those little wobbly seats. Do you remember what those are called, Jill? You can
the wiggle
get
seats that we got?
The wiggle seats. Yeah. Well, those we have
nuts.
We have wiggle stools. Jill and I both have wiggle stools. But you can also get a little cushion that sits on top of any chair that allows you to rock and change position. And those are dynamic. They originally designed them for kids who were squirmy in school, and they let them seriously.
Oh, I know.
Oh, my kids had them.
I know. Mine too. Mine still sit at their wiggle seats at the dinner table.
Exactly. So it just tells you the importance of continuously changing the loading across that joint.
Good luck, Jana. Thank you for calling. Bob in Franklin, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yes. Hello. Thank you. I have a problem with my left shoulder. I had a report a few years ago that said I have severe degeneration of the
acromioclavicular.
Acromioclavicular,
Yep.
And some labral tears.
Okay.
Is there a surgical solution for that?
Sure is. A debridement. Mm-hmm. The first thing I would do is just clean up those labral tears. So the labrum provides a little bit more depth for our shoulder. That's its job. But it's similar to the meniscus in the knee. It kind of helps cushion and stabilize things. And when we get these small micro tears in our labrum, sometimes they can go in and just simply clean that up and do a debridement. And that would help with that. Now, regarding your AC joint, that's a whole different joint. That's a whole different joint and area. That's a little trickier. Almost everybody has arthritis in their AC joint after the age of 40. But it kind of depends on the level if they would consider doing something there, or maybe do a Mumford, Lori. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mumford and near Mumford. And sometimes, and you can see how much the AC joint is contributing to your shoulder symptoms by an AC joint injection. So just like they would inject your knee with cortisone, you know, when you're having a bad pain flare, they can inject the AC joint. I understand it's a relatively uncomfortable injection.
Yes, I've heard that too.
But you can get that injected and you can see if that's contributing to your symptoms or if it's all primarily labrum, and that would help direct any surgical procedure.
Good luck, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Tom in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I need a hip replacement, and my brother and his wife sent me this brochure from Stryker called Mako.
The Mako.
Robotics Total Hip Replacement. And I was wondering if they perform that at the UW.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with that or where I could find out more information.
Yeah, yes, they do. The surgeons typically out at the East Medicine Hospital perform total hip replacements, and they work with Stryker and other manufacturers to put in the implant that seems like the right implant for the patient. There are some surgeons who use robotic assistance for that. So you would need to meet with one of the total hip surgeons and talk to them and find out, you know, what model they use, what manufacturer they use, do they use robotic assistance, what is the plan for it, and then make a decision based upon that information.
And their outcomes, as Larry alluded to earlier, how many have they done with this? What are their outcomes? Those are all great questions that you can ask Tom when you see your surgeon.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Nancy in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. A few weeks ago, when the sisters were on duty, I heard one of them say in loud ringing tones something about the exercises you absolutely should not be doing. Now, this never occurred to me that an exercise might be detrimental to your body. I am a 91-year-old Caucasian woman, and I have very severe osteoporosis. But I like to lie on my back on a solid mattress and lift my legs one at a time to a perpendicular slant from the mattress, and I can wave my toes and my entire leg, of course, straight up in very, very large circles. If I'm raising my right leg, for instance, I can bend that right over my left leg and put my right foot right down on the mattress.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
But I can't move it as far to the right. But my question is this an exercise that I should not be doing because I could twist the ball of my femur right out of the socket if I do this?
Unlikely. No.
Very unlikely.
I would keep doing it. So here's the thing. So you've been doing this. You've been doing it for much of your life. And so your connective tissue, including your bones, has remodeled to tolerate those loads. The problem for some people is they go and they do something like that, and it's a novel activity, and their bone is not modeled to handle that stress applied in that way. So there's something to be said about doing these movements across your lifetime to set you up to prevent fractures and things like that. So I think people get into more trouble when they do things that they're not accustomed to, which is what makes our exercise prescription really difficult, as Jill alluded to at the beginning of the show, like figuring out like what's the right dosage of exercise, what's going to load the bones in a safe manner. So the fact that you've done these for so many years of your life suggests that your bones are tolerating this activity.
Good
Absolutely.
Luck. Keep doing
good
it.
Good for you.
Then.
Yeah. You bet.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks,
Give
Nancy.
Us an update next year.
Yeah.
Kelly in Denmark, your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I have had a few concussions in my life, most recently in January, and am connected with a great physical therapist who has worked on vision exercises with me, but I've also dealt with physical therapists who claim to know about concussions but really don't. Are there strides that are being made through the field to connect vision and physical therapy, such as with dizziness, convergence issues, peripheral vision, things like that, just things that go along with concussions? And I'll take my discussion off there. Thank
you. All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, Kelly, that's a great question. And concussion has become much more of a multidisciplinary approach. And I think we're kind of what Kelly alluded to is she had some visual issues with it. What we're finding is that there are so many facets to this. It could be that you sustained a whiplash and have neck pain and need to see somebody who specializes in cervical spine. There are physical therapists and other healthcare professionals who specialize in treating the visual impairments that come with this, the convergence, the divergence. You may have some dizziness with it, and you need to tease out if that dizziness is related to an inner ear pathology, for example. So to find the right physical therapist to do this is really important. There are sports physical therapists who are trained in this, and there are also neurophysical therapists who have a background in what we call TBI or traumatic brain injury who are trained in this. So finding that right person is really important. And I think I would say as an organization, the American Physical Therapy Association is trying to make strides to bring our neuro world and our orthopedic or sports world together. Because the sports PT people have strengths, the neuro people PT have strengths, and is trying to marry those two.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Elizabeth emailed us, recently diagnosed with a pars defect at L5, experiencing pain in the lower back, buttocks, hip, groin, and down into their leg. Been referred to a pain clinic for an injection and also for physical therapy. Do you have recommendations as to which they do first, PT or injection?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly start with physical therapy. So, you know, the pars defect, was it an acute fracture? So pars is one of the little bony bridges in your low back. So we see that in our young athletes when they have a spondylolysis injury. It's a pars defect. So typically those will heal if it was an acute injury. So I'm not sure what the mechanism of Elizabeth's injury was, but it should heal, and it should heal well with physical therapy intervention. So I would absolutely start with physical therapy. The time we suggest the addition of an injection is if the pain is so great that we cannot make any progress in physical therapy, that people can't assume the positions, postures, they can't get up and down from the floor, they can't do the activities they need to recover, then sometimes an injection can bring the pain down to a level where physical therapy can actually get some traction and help that person recover.
Mm-hmm. Susan in Chippewa Falls emailed, she had an MRI showing torn tendons in the upper arch of her foot, been in a walking cast for a month. What are the chances that this is healing and will she need physical therapy? She's still feeling pain when she flexes her foot.
So torn tendons, boy, I wonder if she tore like
posterior tib, tendon, or the toe
she
flexors?
Says the upper arch of her foot.
The upper arch. Yeah, it sounds like posterior tib.
Yeah. So first of all, she will definitely need physical therapy post this because she's in a cast and she has what we call collateral damage. So not only the insult to the tendons, but all those joints adjacent to that, which have been immobilized, will need some attention. She's still having pain. I guess I wish I knew Susan's age. That would be helpful. But I think you're going to have some pain or discomfort with this. I'm guessing they immobilized her thinking that the tendon was, if she like did an avulsion, it was close enough to heal in place, Lori?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors here. So we don't know for sure which tendon it was. We're assuming that it was posterior tibialis, which case seeing a physical therapist looking at supporting that arch via an arch support of some type so we're not excessively loading, looking at foot mechanics, looking at the mobility of the first ray and the great toe, and how she moves. That there's so much to unpack with this kind of an injury that she's going to need some good physical therapy, as Jill said, not only for the primary injury but the collateral damage of the immobilization. As much as possible, we try to minimize the amount of immobilization because everything that's immobilized atrophies and deteriorates rapidly, really rapidly. Articular cartilage, tendons, ligaments, all of it. So,
all right.
And that's a challenge with the foot. You have so many joints right next to each other. It's virtually impossible not to have that collateral damage.
Right.
Back to lower back pain for a minute. Which sleeping positions are best if you have lower back pain?
Go ahead, Lori.
So for the people with acute back pain who cannot find relief, we put them on their back with their hips and knees at a 90-degree angle. So your legs up on a footstool or something like that. It tends to be a pain-relieving posture. Thereafter, for sleeping, we typically put people on their side with a pillow between their knees. Tends to be most comfortable for people. Jill?
Mm-hmm. Yep, agreed.
Well, on that note, here we are.
Here we are. Out of time again. September. Everyone do your homework.
Everybody do what your therapist tells you. Jill and Lori, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, and we'll see you in a month. We'll do it all over again.
See you then.
Enjoy fall. Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Lori Tine-Brody is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And they'll be back in a month, and we'll do this all over again. Looking ahead to tomorrow on the show, there are many places in Wisconsin with Native American names. And we learn the meanings of words like Waukesha, for example, and why it's important for us to know them. Plus, we hear from the author of a thriller set in Madison, Wisconsin. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.